Oh, it was a sparkling silver day, plenty on the radio, from Kelly Harrington's Olympic success to a novel sparked by a family tragedy and extreme fitness. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
The nation will hold its breath on Sunday, Kelly. So well done. Congratulations.
Hakuna Matata.
Hakuna Matata to you too.
I'm Lily Fagan of Port Limerow, and Kelly is a hero. Yay!
I'm at home here now in West Park, just outside Skibbereen. So I'm very happy to be back here. Like, we've been away for most of the summer with all this roaring lark. So it's good to be back now and see the mammy and all that type of stuff.
And what were we waking up to on the radio? Boxer Kelly Harrington securing silver and on course to take gold on Sunday.
The last few seconds for Harrington. Has she done enough? Has she done enough? Look out to the judges' cards. What a fight that was. What an intriguing battle between these two. They know each other well.
The winner on points by split decision.
It had to be a split.
Advancing to the women's lightweight gold medal final. In red.
She's done it! She's through to Olympic final. Kelly Harrington from St. Mary's Boxing Club in Dublin is through to an Olympic final.
I haven't got a clue what done the damage, because I can't remember, to be honest, what went on in there. But something done the work to win the fight. So, yeah. While I'm here, sorry, just a big shout out to Anna Moore. She's one of the mammies of Irish women's boxing, and she's been there from the start, and she's always sending her love to everybody. So I want to shout out to Anna Moore.
I know you don't care what's going on over your left shoulder in the ring, but it's Podkoinen and it's Ferreira. It's going to be a massive final.
It's going to be a massive fight. It will be what it will be. It'll be exciting. So looking forward to it. And I'll speak with the coaches about it. I'll speak with Noel Bourke about it. And we'll come up with a plan all together. And then we'll start to work on that over the,
you know,
where the final is. But
anyway. You were the flag bearer for the team. You're the flag bearer for the country now come Sunday.
As my brother says, the last mile is never crowded. And that's the way it does feel sometimes. It does feel very lonely. But I suppose that's the difference, isn't it? You know, to be able to hold on in there and keep it going.
The nation will hold its breath on Sunday, Kelly. So well done. Congratulations.
Hakuna Matata.
Hakuna Matata to you too.
Meanwhile, back in Portland Row, Dublin 1, this was the reaction of Kelly's father, Christy, brother Joel, and mother Yvonne.
Very nervous, very nervous. But nice and relaxed now. Kelly has done the business. She's carried the flag proudly, and we're just so proud of her. It's priceless, absolutely priceless. She's a gem.
Tell us a little bit about what it's been like the last few weeks, just in leading up to this, and just, you know, what this has meant to Kelly.
Yeah, exactly. She's in that kind of bracket now where she's just in dreamland. But this is for like 6 years ago, or seven years ago, with Kelly, if she could, like, she had a fight where it didn't go her way and the tears were shed. And all the time she sat in the kitchen crying to me, Dad, it's for our coaches who put endless work into her. It's for that. It's for the women on the corner who there's not a lot to be happy about at the moment. Now there is. Now there's a buzz on the road. Now the country is lifted. Look at it, like, it's everywhere. It's Olympic fever. Like, that's what this is about. It's not. Kelly didn't get here 3 weeks ago. Kelly got here 10, 12 years ago. It's been a lifetime's work for her, like, and she's getting what she deserves. So it's relief, like, and yeah, it's nice. It's nice that she's getting what she deserves.
And Yvonne, what was the atmosphere like in the house? And now, do you have anything planned for Sunday?
Oh, the atmosphere in the house was brilliant. Brilliant. A neighbour knocked over at 6 o'clock and said, can I come in? I said, no. I said, my nerves was that bad. But she came in and, oh, it was great. I was sitting out the back and listening to them and I was saying, oh, God, oh, God. But brilliant, brilliant now. Brilliant. I'm over the moon.
Savouring the moment is Irish boxing team manager Bernard Dunn.
I was amazed at how in control Kelly was, how focused she stayed. Even under that high pressure and expectation, you know, we kind of got a lot of the expectation out of the way when she was guaranteed a medal. Mm. Now it's about, okay, let's take the next step and what colour can we get? And that's what we've been focusing on, you know, really step by step. And it's helped the athletes, not just Kelly, but it's helped the whole team in terms of just being able to focus on the here and now and what we're trying to achieve right now.
So much at stake in these bouts. Did you expect it to be as cagey as it was, particularly in the first round? It's very unusual for at this level to see a situation where the referee has to step in and say, come on, will you do a bit of boxing?
You know, the styles of both opponents, they're both looking to counter, they're both looking, especially the southpaw style that the Thai was fighting for him. She was very straight with that backhand. And you just got to be careful of it, you know, because she's a world-class athlete. And Kelly managed it. She stuck to the plan. You know, even with that interference from the referee, and the referee's doing his job, but even from those wars, she didn't allow it to influence her focus. You know, she stayed in control, and that was the most important piece, staying in control.
How difficult is that, though? Because surely is it human nature for the vast amount of us to adapt to the scenario rather than stick with what presumably has been in the plan since the last bout?
Preparation and process, you know, she stuck the boat, you know, and, you know, it's preparation was extremely, extremely beneficial to the whole squad. We had a great camp in Miyazaki. We had the competition to qualify here not long before that. So we were coming into the games in great shape. Kelly had some fantastic work in Miyazaki, so we've been out of the country since June 30th, so it's been a long process to get here. But Kelly understands what she needs to do each day coming into her belts, and she focuses on that.
When you consider that she's had, two spells and 9 minutes in the ring, it's an awful lot of time to kill and to have to focus on what's at hand. So in many ways, what happened today, is it the relief as much as anything else to actually be in there and competing?
I think the team itself, you know, they look after each other. They're brilliant. You can see the environment around the squad. The whole team was here today cheering Kelly on. When we're back at in the village, we're all together. We eat together. We all kind of go for walks together. There's a bit of dancing goes on in the training sessions. It's a great environment to be in. But when we need to focus on the business, we focus on the business. And credit has to go to the coaches, Zauer, John and Dimitri, the tactical plan. And we've been sitting over the last couple of days in the apartment just watching video after video. And the tactical plan that was put in place was fantastic.
Bernard Dunn in Tokyo. Then later, Samantha Librari was in the tightly knit community where Kelly's from, Portland Row.
Well, good morning, Dustin, from Kelly Harrington country, as we're calling it here. You can hear the horn still honking in the background here. And anyone passing through Portland Row would have no doubt as to where Kelly Harrington has come from. There's posters of her here on almost every house. Every red brick house along this row of terraced houses has green, white and orange bunting flapping in the air. But at 6 o'clock this morning, it was a very quiet place as that fight got underway. But as soon as the winner was decided, after that very tense 10 minutes, the neighbours burst onto the street. Some of them were still in their pyjamas and their dressing gowns, and they headed straight to the Harrington to celebrate with them. I spoke to some of those neighbours to get their reaction.
I can't breathe. I'm ecstatic. I can't breathe.
I am. It wasn't it? It really was. It really was, wasn't it?
She was brilliant. She was brilliant. She gave her all. I'm Lily Fagan of Portland Row, and Kelly is a hero. Yay!
You ran out of the house in your boxer shorts.
Didn't it? She was excellent, but I was a bit worried going to do the tour down, because we just needed two refs to go her way, so that's what was the worrying part. And that's why everybody was up on the tour. Everybody was praying, like, come on, I needed that. Oh, I know what we needed. Lifting the red hand, it was like, yes,
every child, everyone was around. Just a make sure day. This is it, this is the month of August for us now, set. Lift a lot of spirit.
How are you feeling this morning?
Absolutely amazing. I can't believe it, absolutely amazing. She's lifted a lot of spirits around this area. And she's just one amazing girl. I love Kelly. Amazing, yeah. She is. I really and truly.
How long have you known her?
All my life.
Yes.
All my life, yeah.
And did you ever think you'd see this day?
Yes.
Yes, to be honest, because she was always into it. Every time you looked at her, she was running. And Kelly is on her way. She's on her way, on her run. But of course, she deserves this and not more, even. Absolutely more. She's amazing.
Do you think she'll go all the way?
Oh, definitely. 100%, definitely. 100%, yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm up since half three this morning.
Yeah. Is it worth staying up for?
Yes, definitely was. Definitely. Yeah.
Can I ask you? You're the only one I didn't ask. What did you think watching it?
I thought it was really, really good because I was really happy when Kelly won. It means like really amazing to me, and like I just can't believe it really much. So go Kelly.
Go Kelly. Then boxing gold medalist Michael Carruth was talking about the similarities in both his and Kelly's Olympics.
29 years to the day, I think to the day exactly, that you won your semi-final, isn't that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing the similarities between myself and Kelly, because like she won her bronze medal the same day I won my bronze medal. She's after winning her silver medal the same day. She's going to fight for her gold medal the same day I won mine, which is the 8th of August. Obviously, both of us are from Dublin. You know, she was captain of the team as well, or co-captain of the team. So, you know, a lot of similarities. I'm hoping on the 8th of August after 6 o'clock in the morning that we have similarities, that she is an Olympic gold medalist. You know?
Okay. So, what did you do between your semi-final and your final? What advice could you give to Kelly?
Just try to stay as relaxed as you can. Don't be thinking about it too much. You know what I mean? I was very good mentally in relation to getting ready for the fight. I'd switch on about 15, 20 minutes before the fight, you know. Everything else was jovial and, you know, relaxing and things like that. But I had a good way about myself before I ever got in and boxed. No matter was an Olympic final or a County Dublin League final, I always kept myself relaxed as much as I can. I used to play the music. She probably does that as well. She has her earphones on as well. You know, into your own little world. Don't think about it too much. Don't, you know, you'll do the tactics probably the night before with the coaches and things like that, and working on the plan A, B and C. As I mentioned already, you know, if that doesn't work, the great fighters find D, E and F when they need it as well. So she's one of those type of boxers that can adapt to a lot of things. She's up against a very tough Brazilian boxer. She's really tough. She's got all the punches. She's very aggressive, you know. So what Kelly just needs to do is, you know, she needs to stay on her bike, up on her toes, and keep boxing the way she's been boxing the last three fights, you know. So she just, but more importantly is, you know, you have to make your weight as well. Yeah. Things like that. I think her weight is very good. She's no trouble with that, which is brilliant. Get as much rest as you can now as possible. You can't get any fitter now, you know what I mean? So it's get as much rest as you can and try not to think about it too much, you know.
One big difference, of course, no crowds this time, no family there with her.
Yeah.
But also, unlike when you fought, there was no phones really in your time. Nobody bothering you in that way.
No, you're not getting bothered with, you know, harassment. You know, I'm going to say media, you know, you're going to get, you know, she's not going to have that to worry about. My family were going to come over to Barcelona, but myself and my father asked them not to come because we didn't need pressure that, you know, you'd be worried if they were in the arena or not, you know what I mean? So with that, we, you know, she's, you know, they're going to keep, she's got two great coaches there in Zor and John. And Dimitri, if I should say, 73. And, you know, they'll keep her relaxed. The rest of her team will keep her relaxed as well. She's been in a world championship. You know, she's gone to the pinnacle there. So she's used to, you know, big arenas, and she's used to, you know, not maybe having crowds supporting her as well. So because you can't be travelling all around the world the way the boxers are now in this day and age. So, it's you know, it'd be great for, obviously, for Dublin, for Ireland, and obviously for boxing, if she can actually take this gold medal home.
Olympic gold medalist Michael Carruth with Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland. Then later, Anna Moore, the woman getting the shout out from Kelly after the fight, turned up on the live line with Joe.
This is what Kelly said this morning after a victory when she was talking to Joe Stack.
While I'm here, sorry, just a big shout out to Anna Moore. She's one of the mammies of Irish women's boxing, and she's been there from the start, and she's always sending her love to everybody. So I want to shout out to Anna Moore.
And a shout out to Anna Moore. Anna Moore, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You're one, what does Kelly describe, one of the mammies of Irish boxing?
Yeah, they call me their mammy.
Their mammy, okay. And who are you, Anna?
My name is Anna Moore, and I come from Limerick.
What was your reaction when you heard Katie shout out your name?
I was after watching the contest, so I was on a high.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I just hear my name coming out. I was shocked because, if you think of it, Joe, she was after coming out of the ring, winning a silver medal, going for gold.
Yeah, yeah.
And she actually thought of me.
Just a big shout out to Anna Moore. She's one of the mammies of Irish women's boxing, and she's been there from the start, and she's
brilliant.
Always sending her love to everybody, so I want to shout out to Anna Moore.
So you've been there from the start, Anna. Tell us how you first became involved in boxing.
Well, when I started going with my husband when I was 16, he was a boxer. And years later, he went back to the club as a coach. Mm-hmm. And my sons, he won two Irish boxing titles when he was young.
Okay.
And then my sons took it up. So when my sons were old enough, my husband stepped back. So I decided, I'm not a sit-at-home person, so I decided, well, I'll get involved as well. So I started doing the tees and the doors, and I progressed from there to do my coaches, and I went on from there to do judging, and I done international world body judging, and then when the girls were good enough, they started in 2000, end of 2001-2, when they were good enough and we had them to the standard of where they could go and box internationally, I was asked to come on board as one of the managers.
Fantastic. And Anna, have you ever boxed?
No, but I would have loved it if it was there when I was young.
Okay.
It wasn't there. Before, about 2 years before women's boxing was allowed, the medical board wouldn't allow it.
Oh, would they not?
They said
know?
It wasn't safe. But the minute that they approved it, our president at the time, Dominic O'Rourke, who is also our president now, and our central council, which runs the boxing, they immediately got on board to get a woman from each province to go on this committee so that we could start up doing competitions and eventually championships for these boxers.
And Anna couldn't be more proud of Kelly.
So Anna, what do you want to say to Kelly?
I just want to tell Kelly I love her so much, but she knows that. She knows, and all the girls.
You love her. You love her.
Oh, I do. I do love Kelly, and I love all the girls, and I love boxing. My heart is in boxing, and I really do, Joe. It's my sport, and I love it. And you see those girls? Yeah. I've been with them, not just Kelly, all of them. They've come up through the ranks, and I've watched them. And I've seen them improve, and I've seen them progress. I've seen them leave as well, and sad to see some of them leave, you know. But they'll always be my girls, Joe, always.
That's fantastic. Yeah, fantastic, Anna. But Anna, you know the way you told me at the start that female boxing wasn't allowed?
No.
You'd still get some people saying, well, it's too rough.
Well, I'll tell you, when it started, I wasn't too enthusiastic about it either, Joe.
Okay.
I'll be honest about it.
Yeah.
And you see, when clubs started taking girls into their clubs, they had to be very, very careful. You know, if you hadn't, a female coach in there.
Oh, of course, yeah, I understand that.
You know,
child
protection,
you
had to
absolutely.
Be very careful.
Yeah, yeah.
So that meant that they had to go away and either get a parent to stay there the whole time or to train somebody up as a female coach. Now, we're very lucky now. We have great female coaches around Ireland. Now we have. But then the expense of it then, you had to get special dressing rooms.
Yeah, of course. Good point. Yeah, yeah.
You know, even in the stadium, in the beginning,
bathrooms,
for the first two
everything.
Or three
yeah,
years,
yeah.
We had no dressing rooms. They had to get changed in the toilets. But thank God, as I said, our council has always been behind female boxing, and they have done everything they can to improve female boxing. But we have great youths and juniors. Our youths that are coming up will be every bit as good, please God, as Kelly, and they're our next Olympians, and they have to be. We have to treat them properly to keep them.
Okay, I asked you what Kelly would have done after the bout this morning. What did you do?
What did I do?
Yeah.
When I was watching what she was saying about me, I sat down crying.
Okay.
I cried, and I didn't just cry; I was screaming, crying.
Yeah.
To think that she thought, after coming out winning that contest, that she thought enough of me.
While I'm here, sorry, just a big shout out to Anna Moore. She's one of the mammies of Irish women's boxing, and she's been there from the start, and she's always sending her love to everybody, so I want to shout out to Anna Moore.
Completely unprompted, Kelly broke into that, and this is Anna Moore on the other line. And you were screaming, crying.
I was, Joe, I was.
Okay.
That she thought enough of me, you know.
Of course. And what did you do next?
Next, what did I do? I hadn't time. I was getting messages from everybody, Joe.
Okay.
I was getting phone calls from everybody. It was like I was a celebrity, which I'm not. I'm just an ordinary person.
Yeah. But you went to Mass.
Oh, I went to Mass. Oh, I did, to thank God, because I had asked him yesterday to make sure Kelly won. So I went up to thank him and give him a few bob this morning.
So What did you intone to God yesterday? Please, did you say, please let her be safe? Or that's a given?
I asked God to keep Kelly safe in the ring and to bring her to victory.
Okay.
Anna Moore on the live line with Joe Duffy. And in the morning, another high-achieving sportswoman, Baz Ajmawi, was talking to a record-breaking Mayo woman, Orla Dempsey.
This is the quote. I'm not actually into rowing. I've never rowed a boat in my life. That's according to a Mayo woman called Orla Dempsey, who has just broken a world record along with her two crewmates after rowing 2,400 nautical miles from San Francisco to Hawaii in aid of various charities. Orla joins me live now from Hawaii to tell me about the epic journey. Orla.
Baz, how's it going?
What is wrong with you?
Yeah, I don't know. I've asked myself that a few times over the last 2 months.
I need to know. So firstly, where are you from? And how did you end up in Dubai? And what are you doing in Dubai?
So I'm from Baal, just outside Castlebar in Mayo. And I just moved over to Dubai when I was finished college, just got a job and went over for a bit of an adventure. And I'm a teacher over there. I teach PE in one of the schools in Dubai. So, yeah, just sort of went on a whim. And that's how I ended up there.
And how, tell me this, Orla, how did someone who hadn't rowed before in their life actually end up being part of a crew that breaks a world record like that?
Yeah, through my friend Jane, one of the other crewmates, they needed a crew member towards the end of January, and she knew I'd be up for it, so she just kind of sent me a WhatsApp and was like, "We need a crew member. Are you interested?" And yeah, I just said, "Yeah, why not? What an opportunity! What an honor to be asked to take part in something like that." So I couldn't turn it down. Yeah, I had no experience, but that was the worst that can happen.
See, that'll show you the difference between me and you, because if Jane had to text me, she would have got a very colourful response to that. So tell me, what's your athletic background? Give me, because you're obviously a sporty person, Orla.
Nothing too crazy, to be honest. Just a couple of clubs. I play Gaelic football out in Dubai, and I play rugby, and just keeping generally fit, like a bit of running, a bit of cycling. I attempt doggy paddle when I swim, but nothing too glamorous now, more than the average person, just keeping fit generally.
And tell me tell me about the crew then. You've obviously made many friends there, but who are also part of the crew and what's their background?
So Jane is ex-military. She was 10 years in the British Army as a Royal Engineer.
Wow.
And she's a PTI, so also very modestly an ex-international rugby player. She played for England. And Vicky is a fitness expert. She owns the only bar studio in London, and she's been in the bar industry for the last 10-11 years, and she appeared on SAS Who Dares Wins a couple of years ago. She was the only female, I think, to reach the quarterfinals or the final eight or something like that. So yeah, pretty
well,
impressive.
You sound like quite an impressive army of women.
Yeah, I guess so. And we didn't know each other. Jane and I knew each other, obviously, from Dubai, but I hadn't met Vicky until 2 or 3 days, or well, a bit more, probably 5 or 6 days before we set off. First time I met Vicky was in San Francisco. So I
love the fact, Orla, you were just like, I'll go. Were you just like, sure, I give it a crack. Yeah, no bother. I'll go break world records. Like, who actually came up with the idea? Like, how did the idea come about?
So it's an organized race, the Great Pacific Race. I think this was its fourth year. And Vicky got involved with it a couple of years ago, and various things happened. Obviously, COVID happened, a lot of things changed and crew changed. So she carried it forward for the 2021 race. And that was it. Three girls had done it before us in 2018, the first three ever to do it, three females. So they kind of set a mark, I guess. And, you know, once that's set, people want to break it, don't they? So that was our next challenge, was to try and break that record. So, with absolutely zero experience between the three of us.
I'm just a bit in awe of you. I just think you're great. So tell me this. Once you were confirmed as a member of the crew, what, how much training was involved?
There was a bit. So I was training quite a lot as it was anyways, strength training. So I just continued on with that and added in a couple of longer rows in the week. So I'd have to just sit in the rowing machine for 2-3 hours at a time, just get used to being in that position for an extended period of time. But I didn't really take the physical training too seriously. Do you know, it was it's a big mental challenge, really, more than anything. So I guess, you know, I just tipped away at my own training and tried to enjoy the journey to get into San Francisco as much as I could.
And the journey was grueling.
From the day we set off, I guess we had between the weather and between our lack of knowledge and our lack of experience, you know, we kind of feel like we really did get everything thrown at us, from equipment breaking to losing some parts to then getting stuck in some of the worst storms that the Pacific has seen in years.
Oh God.
Throughout it, yeah, we spent a lot of time on power anchor, which meant like three of us were just rammed in this tiny little cabin, bent around like pretzels for days on end, waiting for the storm to pass, and eating cold porridge and whatever snacks that we could smuggle in before we had to get the anchor out and things like that.
Sounds fabulous. Tell me this, how many days were you out there?
60 days.
I just can't believe that. And you knew you'd be there for 60 days. You kind of had that idea going out.
Yeah, that was the aim when we set off, was 60 days. The record was 62 and 17 hours. So we kind of had hoped for 60 days, but we were also very aware that your time is very dependent on the weather. So yeah, we were hopeful for 60 days, but you know, we didn't know right until the very end if we were going to make it in or not, you know, in time.
And how do you motivate yourself? Is there any things to look forward to along the way? Like, are you just in the zone? Is it?
Yeah, well, yeah, we had to have little wins every day. So, for example, me and Jane would split our bag of Maltesers every day. So we had a fun size bag of Maltesers, and we had one Freddo.
Oh my God,
between
I should hook you up with Jennifer Aniston. She eats one Malteser a day for her. I was just reading that earlier on. So your little treat was you'd share a pack of Maltesers or something like that, is it?
Yeah, so we'd get either 4 or 5 Maltesers each, depending on the bag.
Oh my God.
Found out that Maltesers treat size bags vary by 2 Maltesers. And half a Freddo.
Half a Freddo.
We would have that every day. Yeah, we'd split a Freddo. I'd get the top and she'd get the legs.
You just cracked. You're cracked in the head. Listen, tell me this. Was there at any stage you realised, oh my God, there's a world record on the cards here? Did that happen at any stage? when was that?
It did. Well, we had the oh God, the world record is gone stage on day 28. So that was a bit rough. But then once we kind of got going, but probably it wasn't until day 54 that we were really like, okay, we need to push on now and we can get the record.
Mayo woman Orla Dempsey with Baz Ajmawi in the morning. And could it be true, the mullet, the two haircuts on one head, is back? Catherine Thomas was talking about it in the afternoon.
I hate to be the bearer of bad news, lads, but mullets are back. Billy Ray Cyrus will be delighted because it is true, mullets are back. I was reading this morning about Australian sprinter Rowan Browning. He may not have made it to the final, but he certainly ran with style in the 100 metres qualifying heat at the Olympics in Tokyo with his mullet blowing in the breeze. And we had to address this very serious issue because we've noticed mullets walking around Dublin. They seem to be back. I'm joined on the line now by Mark O'Keefe, hairdresser and managing director of Sugar Culture. How are you, sir?
I'm great, Catherine. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm good. I have seen them. I thought it could be a phase. I thought it could be post-pandemic, people not getting into the barbers yet. But they are making a comeback.
Yeah, and they have been for a while. I have a nephew who plays rugby for Towie Newry's on the Jays, and it seemed to happen even before COVID, where some of the young lads involved in rugby were getting mullets. We noticed it out in Black Rock, where fellas from Black Rock College and Michaels were getting it. So it did start before COVID, but it definitely grew legs during COVID and during the lockdown. So yeah, they have made a comeback for sure.
Okay, and are you a fan? Like, what do you think of the mullet?
Well, Catherine, I'm rocking a little mullet. I have been for some time, yeah.
I know.
I've always been a bit of a fan of a mullet and a mohawk. So yeah, I have to say, I would support it big time.
So it's not just a COVID thing. It's not just a post-pandemic thing. And so is it just teens and early 20s? Or I know you've always been cool, but yeah. Is it going across the board?
No, I think, you know me, I'm always trying to hold on to my youth in some shape or form. So I wouldn't be the norm for my age bracket. But no, I think it's fair to say it would definitely be teens, early to mid-20s. And look, I think it was one of those things where when lads had the clippers, it was so much easier.
Yeah.
When we were all closed, just to shave the sides of your head and not worry about the back or the top. And then, of course, it became a bit of a fad and a bit of a cool thing to do. So that's where I suppose it did stem from. But it has, even though we've opened back up, lads are still happy to come in and get nice fades on the side and leave the sides and back and embrace a bit of curl and a bit of length and a bit of texture. So, and look, they're having a bit of fun with it. So who can knock? I sent a photograph on to one of your researchers today. And,
yeah.
You know, there's some really, really cool mullets going around.
So that was the thing. That's what I've noticed. There's a lot of kids going around with shaved at the side, both sides, like short, like shaved, and then the kind of the short at the top and then the long at the back. So the mullet has moved into the 21st century. Like, it's not Billy Ray Cyrus stuck in the 80s.
No, it's not. And I suppose the original mullet came from a practical reason where people were trying to protect the backs of their neck from the sun, and that's where the term redneck came from. But, I mean, you touched on Australia.
Mm.
The mullet in Australia has been on trend for some time, and New Zealand, and I think that's why it crossed over into the rugby world over here.
Yeah.
But, yeah, look, it's definitely something that has moved into the 21st century, and it has an edginess and, like I said, a bit of a trend to it. So, yeah, like, I think it's going to keep going for a while.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a perm in the hair now as well. Have you seen that?
No. No.
Yeah. So
what?
The perm is coming back, but not with women. It's coming back with young guys. And again, they're now going for really curly mullets and really curly mohawks. So young guys are seemingly really embracing kind of, I suppose, thinking outside the box with their hair.
Mm.
Where a lot of girls have gone quite formal with the hair, and they're sticking with balayage and that kind of more beautiful type of hair and long hair. And guys, I think, are being a lot more adventurous with new looks.
Mark O'Keefe with Catherine Thomas in the afternoon. And in the morning, Sheila Killian's first novel is called Something Bigger, and it's inspired by her great aunt and a family tragedy, as she was telling Baz Ajmawi.
The woman is Marcella Coyle, who we knew as Auntie Fiss when I was growing up. And it's kind of like you've been talking about, you know, the time when you're a child, it's very special, and the people you interact with, children and old people, can get quite close. So Auntie Fiss, I knew her as a very old lady. She had spent all her life, most of her life, in the deep south in Alabama. She went over from Roscommon when she was only 14. She
what period are you talking about? What time are you talking about?
Okay, she went to the States in 1903 when she was 14. And she came back. She did visit in between, but she came back in the kind of mid-60s, around the time I was a baby, and basically stayed with us for the rest of her life. So I knew her as a kind of a grandmother figure. But, of course, by then she was a real Southern lady. You know, she had the Southern drawl and she used all the Southern slang. And
she must have stood out quite a lot, I imagine, did she?
She was fairly exciting there in South Roscommon in the 60s and 70s. She was a very interesting lady. And she told us all these stories of the South, and particularly the big story that defined her, I think, was the story about her brother, who is Father James Coyle, who is the priest that she went out to live with. He was much older than her. And he was actually came into conflict with the Ku Klux Klan in Birmingham, Alabama. And that was, I think, the big defining event of her life. And she still talked about it, even 50 or 60 years later, to us as small children.
That's amazing. So she ended up living with the brother when she immigrated. Is that right?
Yeah, she went over to live with him, and so she finished her schooling over there. And she was only 14, you know, and at the time going to the States, you know, you didn't know if you'd come back or not come back. And going to Alabama was unusual enough for Irish people because, you know, the big Irish-American stories are mostly around New York and Chicago and Boston. So Alabama and the Deep South generally around that time was a very different place.
It's a very I've travelled there around quite a lot of there, and it's still quite different, isn't it?
Isn't it?
You know,
yeah,
it feels very alien. Tell me, what was the brother's name?
Brother's name was James Coyle, Father James Coyle, okay. James Edwin.
So tell me,
Jimmy, as we knew him.
Jimmy. So tell me about Jimmy. What was Jimmy's story?
Well, Jimmy was also grew up in South Roscommon, became a priest, ordained in Rome, and went straight over to the States. That was common enough at the time for priests to go to America. And he was a teacher first in Alabama, and then he took over this big, busy parish in Birmingham, Alabama. And Birmingham was a big boom town. It was very driven by money. And it was very driven by coal and steel. So when World War One came along, there were fortunes being made. And obviously America was completely allied with Britain. So then Ireland became independent and Jimmy was delighted. And this kind of was strike one against Jimmy, if you like. He seemed slightly traitorous. Also, he was Catholic and the Ku Klux Klan revived and they were quite anti-Catholic. But the biggest thing is, I guess, he was very egalitarian. He didn't distinguish between people.
He was progressive in that way, wasn't he?
Very progressive, which is very unusual at the time. Like, when I was researching his life, the novel is fiction, but I was researching his life, like, he was an honorary member of a lot of Italian associations and the Syrian Brotherhood. And it's not the usual Irish-American story. He was he just saw everybody as equal, which should be normal, but wasn't really normal at the time.
And of course, the Ku Klux Klan, they had issues with Catholicism, obviously. And then I suppose the masses were in Latin and things like that. So obviously they didn't like
The way they talked about Catholics is kind of like it really had echoes when I was writing the book of, like, you know, the later years of the Trump presidency or populism in Britain or even here. You know, the way some people talk about immigrants. And they talk about people of different religions as being kind of not to be trusted and not really loyal. And that's the way people talked about Catholics at the time. Like, it's complete racism.
And then Sheila spoke about the events of the 21st of August, 1921.
Well, Jimmy was already in the crosshairs of the Klan, if you like, because he had taken issue with them very publicly. He debated a lot in the newspapers. He was very articulate, outspoken kind of a man. Marcella was living in the rectory. She was helping out in parish work, so she lived with him. This had also become her second childhood home, if you like. She lived there from when she was 14. She's now in her 30s, and Jimmy, I think, is 46. So, basically, a wedding service was performed. The bride and groom, the bride was a young woman, and the groom was a little older. He was a Puerto Rican man. He was Catholic. She was not. She converted to Catholicism to marry him. Her dad was in the Ku Klux Klan. And this enraged him in all manner of ways. His precious daughter becoming a Catholic, marrying a man who, like, is Puerto Rican. But for him, that wasn't white
except
enough.
Basically. What was the reaction to that?
The reaction was quick and fatal, Baz. That very evening, he walked up to the rectory and shot my granduncle dead.
Unbelievable. And tell me this, was that big news at the time in the US?
It was huge news in the US, and it still remains big news in Birmingham. Jimmy's very well remembered in Birmingham, more than he is, Birmingham, Alabama, that is, more than he is here. So he's still remembered in, obviously, in Catholic circles and in the parish, but he's also, and this is something the family are very proud of, he's remembered in the Birmingham Institute of Civil Rights, which is, that's a big museum of civil rights. You know, it kind of links to Martin Luther King and so on. It's an important one. And, like, Jimmy is one of very few. There are two Irish guys that I know of who are there. One is Jimmy, which we're really pleased of. The other is the Bull Connor, who was the police chief in the 1960s civil rights, who is remembered slightly differently. He's very well remembered there. Even, like in bookshops or in the library, you mention, like, when I was there.
What a man. What a man. Like, honestly, to leave your mark there. Tell me this. Did you go there to write the book? Did you spend some time in the Deep South?
I did get to spend some time there, and like you've travelled there, so you know it's one thing to read about it, but you really need to go there and you hear. Like, there's still a big separateness there, isn't there? Did you find that?
I did. I found it an unusually alien place, yeah. When you compare it to the back of the landscape of travelling through America. It stood. There's parts of it I loved, but there was parts of it I found quite eerie, if I'm honest with you, you know?
Yeah, similarly. And we had lived in South Africa for a while, so it had echoes of that, you know, like apartheid is obviously long gone, but there's still a division that isn't just based on income, like it's still based on race. So it is good to experience that and to feel it and to see, you know, what people, the way people talk and what they mean by when they say what they say, which isn't always obvious until you're there.
I have to ask, what happened to your aunt? It's just, I'm getting you to tell me the whole book now. But
no, it's okay. Luckily, it's not the whole book, because the book is fiction. But in real life,
yeah,
Marcella, she came back home in her old age. She lived all her life in the Deep South. She stayed there afterwards. She moved to Mobile. Obviously, she'd been living in the rectory, so there she lost another home. You know, she couldn't live there anymore. Her brother wasn't a priest. So she came back home in kind of the mid-60s, and she lived with my dad, who was her nephew. And so she lived with us, and for us, for particularly the younger ones in my family, myself and my brother,
yeah.
She was a real warm grandmother figure. Like, you know, she'd read the stories and she'd buy us jelly sweets, and she was an exciting
she
kind of
figure. She sounds fantastic. Sheila, I could talk to you all day. Tell me the name of the book.
It's Something Bigger, and it's published by Caritas Press.
Sheila Killian with Baz in the Morning. And in the morning, sports presenter Anna Geary was talking to Philip Boucher-Hayes about extreme fitness routines.
Yeah, so I suppose there's what I wanted to give is people a flavour of what's out there, because sometimes people can find exercise a bit monotonous and they want to challenge themselves but they don't know how. So there's loads of different ways. So I picked out a few things that they can do, and I've tried some of these myself, failed miserably at some of them, but you know what? God loves a trier. So I suppose I'm going to start off with CrossFit, because it's something that people hear about a lot and sometimes it can have a bit of a bad rep. But I've tried it myself a few times and I've probably been one of the least able in the class, because it is something, it's a community orientated environment. They're very much focused on all levels. And sometimes you hear about CrossFit, you think, oh, I'd have to be extremely fit or extremely able to do that.
Surely it's one of those, it's only as hard as you push yourself kind of sports.
It is. But I suppose the environment that it is quite intense. It is about speed. And I suppose sometimes when people are in there, they're looking to the left and to the right of them and thinking, oh, well, that person's lifting this, I need to match them. Yeah. And I suppose that's where the danger is.
I'm completely resistant to that kind of peer pressure.
Well, and that's the danger is then, because you can, you know, with fatigue comes a decrease in your technique and form, so you could actually end up getting injured. But they really do promote that any level is welcome, and that, again, like you just said, it's all about your level, your pace. You have to start somewhere.
Yeah, you said that this was about also relieving monotony and finding other ways of getting fit. Is CrossFit not pretty monotonous?
See, it's not. And that, again, another misconception. People think it's just another form of HIIT training. But really, with, like, I suppose with CrossFit, there's things like hitting it, gymnastics movements, strongman movements. They have Olympic weightlifting. There's more in cardio endurance-based stuff. And they try and pique people's attention by constantly varying the movements. So if you go into every class, it's always going to be different. So you'll have a workout of the day, where sometimes you're kind of doing a specific workout for time. Other times you're kind of do as many rounds as possible in a given time. And you're challenging yourself with different movements all the time.
Yeah,
so,
but basically, I mean, your feet go in one direction, your arms go in the other.
But isn't that what all types of movement and fitness is? Okay, I'm losing ears. So that is.
You never had me in the first place. That was
wait,
the problem.
Wait, get onto the ice bath. Maybe that might grab your attention. And I suppose, like, that is something that people can try, but that's maybe for people that are already in the gyms lifting weights and want to challenge themselves a bit more. That could be something they'll do. But then for people that are into their cardio, into their 5K runs, and they're thinking, oh, I'm doing the same route all the time. There's options for them. Things like, I suppose, adventure races are really exciting, because they get people to do it in a group. You can grab your friends, and there's adventure races all over the country that you can do. Things like, there's Gale Force in Dublin, Westport Sea to Summit. They combine things like running, cycling, mountain biking. Yeah. And again, there's a fun element to them as well. You know, you're not having to do them for your maximum capacity, but you are pushing yourself out of your comfort zone and trying something different.
And it's low impact. Your knees and your ankles are not going to be feeling it in the same way they would if you go out and start pounding pavement.
Yeah, well, I suppose there is a run running element to it, but it does mix it up. So, and depending on your ability, there's longer races. So like some of them are 50K, others are more like 25K. So you're doing a mix of different things.
And if that's not tough enough, there's always the Ironman.
Like the Ironman has become so popular in recent times. Now, it really isn't for the faint-hearted, but if you are somebody that wants, just to give you an idea of it, if you want to push yourself, it's almost a 2.5 mile swim, just 2.4 under that, 112 mile bike ride, and then 26.2. So it's a marathon you run as well. So like that is massively for not for the faint-hearted, but there's half Ironmans. You can bring it down again to triathlon. You can do sprint triathlons, which are much more achievable. It's a 750 metre swim, 20k bike ride and a 5k run.
The biggest hurdle for me to think about overcoming there would be the transition from the pool mm-hmm. to the sea, isn't it?
And that's the thing. And I suppose for me, if you are trying something different, like getting the advice of someone that's already doing it or getting a little bit of help is important, because if you're going to try it, you want to make sure that you don't drown. Yeah. Well, yeah. And also that, you know, even things like taking the bike from one transition period to the next or taking off the wetsuit, all of those things, yeah, I would imagine.
Taking off the wetsuit, I mean, it should actually be a sport in itself. It looks so bloody difficult.
Well, putting on a wetsuit for me is a sport in itself for sure. But then if people want to take things a little bit differently, if they want to more focus on the mindfulness and the mental health and the stress reduction, and you don't particularly want to put too much stress on your joints, things like hot yoga. I tried Bikram yoga a few years ago.
Okay, first principles here. What is hot yoga?
Yeah,
please?
So it is yoga. So it is a series of different standing and stretching postures. There's 26 of them in total, except you're doing it in hot, humid conditions. So the heat can range from in around 33 degrees to 40 degrees. So if you're someone that wants to feel the heat in your bones, maybe this is the place for you to go. The only thing I'll say to you, and I'll give you a little bit of warning, you do have to withstand the smell of feet. It was the one downside for me. Now, I won't lie, I was really impressed with the class.
Was this your own feet, Anna?
Well, I'm going to say it wasn't, but maybe it was. But that's the only thing, because obviously with the heat and people are barefoot, it's something to contend with, okay, if you're someone that doesn't particularly like feet.
All right, okay. Smells aside, what did it do to your body? What did you feel like afterwards?
Do you know what? I really felt refreshed. I find like yoga, we all know the benefits of it and the stress reduction element and all the benefits for our well-being. Sometimes I struggle with yoga because I think as a sports person, I'm preconditioned to think that unless I'm sweating, I'm not working out. So with hot yoga, you are sweating buckets. I mean, it's almost like you've stood in a shower. Like you come out feeling so refreshed though. And like it's aiding in flexibility. But as well, I suppose the added benefits on top of yoga is that you do burn more calories. It is much more of a workout in that heated environment. And again, it's so good for our bodies just to manipulate in different ways. The one thing I would say is to be careful of is to not overstretch. Because sometimes when you're in a heated environment, your muscles might be that bit more limber. So,
So
it's making sure that you don't push your body beyond that point. But again, when you have an instructor, they're there to guide you. You can, like, I went into hot yoga.
Sorry, it's just so I understand here. It's not just yoga with more sweat. It means that you can stretch further, push yourself further.
Exactly, because you're in that environment that it allows your muscles to be that little bit more limber. So it is about taking it at your pace. Like, I went into hot yoga having never really practiced yoga before. And I go, sports person in me wanted to be one of the best in the class. But I quickly realised that my ability to, you know, do a warrior pose and stretch out my legs, you know, wasn't at the same level as other people. So with all of these things, this is just about giving you food for thought. It is about, you know, allowing you to try new things, but it doesn't mean you have to be the best at them.
Anna Geary on Today with Philip Boucher Hayes. Now, after Baz spoke about returning to stay in his family home, Tess got in touch to tell him all about her memories of her childhood home in Templemore.
We had a big old house in the main street in Templemore, and it was a kind of an open house. My mother would do all sorts of things, like to keep the show going. She would have coffee and teas, selling them, and all little sandwiches. She started off with a couple of tables, and she built up to a full room of tables. And
oh, like a tea room kind of thing?
Like a little tea room.
Lovely.
She had two tables, and when she got enough money, then she'd get another one. And people were coming in and out and having a cup of tea. But our house, our kitchen would be an open house. Like, it was on the main street, and everybody came in and out. And, like, you wouldn't know who'd be there for dinner or and any hour of the day or night. They'd have tea and a game of cards could go on all night. Game of 25. It was a great house for...
That's a gas. That's a gas way to grow up, though, isn't it, with an open house like that?
It is. Like, we could have somebody for Christmas dinner. There'd be a space left there, and we'd be wondering, who has she now for the dinner? You know, she could have... somebody that was living on their own, but you wouldn't know till dinner time they'd arrive on. And you know, she was a great woman, and Daddy, they were great cooks. There was always food. We had no luxuries, but we always had food on the table.
And tell me this: have you revisited since? Have you seen it?
It's passed through our hands. My mum and dad passed away a good few years ago, and my sister sold it. It was too big a house for one person to manage. It was kind of two houses in one.
And have you gone? Do you ever think of going back and asking the people who own it now to have a look around?
Oh, it's all changed. It's now the local credit union.
It's what?
Yeah, it's got changed. So I can't go back and show the kids the great house we had, or go through the rooms. I'd love to go through the rooms. Like, there were big old rooms with the fireplaces in them, and you'd have the smoky room because the chimney was cracked, and you'd have the pink room, and you had Uncle Jack's room, and
that's gas. And now you walk around into the credit union.
Yeah, but I have never gone in there. I just have to remember it the way it was.
You've got really lovely memories of it. I love the fact you're even talking about playing 25. I caught my 11-year-old. My mum is teaching her cards. I'm not sure if that's a good or bad thing, Tess, to be honest with you.
That's a good thing. It's a good thing. I think it is. For money.
That's Tess talking to Baz in the morning. And in the afternoon, Catherine Thomas was talking to Tokyo Olympic gold medalist Paul O'Donovan.
Now, they may say that there's nothing special about us and a lot of hard work can get you there, but we are still in awe of our lightweight men's double sculls heroes, Paul O'Donovan and Fintan McCarthy. Olympic gold medalist and FBD insurance ambassador Paul O'Donovan is on the line. How are you, sir? Where are you, by the way?
Me? I'm at home here now in West Cork, just outside Skibbereen. So very happy to be back here. Like, we've been away for most of the summer with all this rowing lark. So it's good to be back now and see the mammy and all that type of stuff.
What was the first dinner she cooked you when you got home?
It was bacon, actually. Bacon and spuds.
Nice.
Yeah, class. You missed it.
Come
they
here.
Don't do great spuds in Japan, for some reason. No, they have great sushi, but can't do potatoes.
And are you a fan of sushi?
I like it. I do. Yeah. I like seafood, but I suppose we're not too far away from the sea down here as well. So we'll be used to eating all the mussels and the fresh fish and all that stuff. So I like the sushi then.
Lovely. Listen, huge congratulations to you again, and to Fintan and Emily, of course. I was actually down in Skib on the morning everyone woke up to the news of your win, and we were filming down there, and I witnessed the goalpost boxes with my own eyes, and there was just a great buzz and a great sense of pride about the place. And I drove the road out, actually, I was heading to Ballydehob from Baltimore, and I drove past the rowing club, and it's just brilliant. I mean, the sense of pride locally coming back, because obviously last time with Rio with the silver medal, the whole town went berserk and mental and turned out to greet you. With the old COVID restrictions still in place, was it a different sort of a welcome for yourself and Fintan, or how was it?
For sure. Well, there was Emily Hegarty as well, with her bronze medal, was coming back, and we had Lydia and Gary were the spares, who was kind of five, was coming home. But definitely, for sure, it's different to last time coming home. But I actually preferred it, to be honest, because we were overwhelmed last time. There was like millions of people down in Skibbereen, and it was just too much. But now, there's only a small crowd there, like only the close friends and family. So you can actually have a nice little conversation with them, rather than before you even get the first word of a sentence out to someone, there's someone else pulling in another direction and stuff if there's too many people. So it's been good for us, I think.
Okay.
And sure, maybe a little later on in the year, if things get better, they can have a big celebration then and invite the millions out to Skibbereen for a party or something.
Well, listen, there'd be a queue of people trying to get in. And the traffic in Skibbereen can be bad enough at the best of times. But come here, where is the gold medal at the moment?
So I was doing some pictures there for FBD, because they've been supporting me a long time. So I was out in the rowing club doing that. But with the medal, I left it in the car then. Since then, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, we all love you because you're so relaxed and you're so down to earth. But like, winning the gold medal at the Olympics, does it? It has to feel different, you know. I mean, does it feel bigger? Has it sunk in?
No, I don't think I can't figure out what there would be to sink in. Like, Joe's nice for sure. I suppose, but I don't. I just can't. I don't feel different like at all.
Okay, and it's interesting.
You'd obviously be very happy, but I think I'd try to be happy about life anyway. You know.
Yeah.
So.
And it's interesting because I was listening to Kelly Harrington obviously this morning as well, and she was saying the same. It's not the medals. It's the sense of pride and the people at home and who's behind you and who's supporting you. Did you see her match this morning?
I haven't seen it yet. No, I was on very early, and I've been training and stuff since. But I'm going to try and catch a repeat now if I can.
Yeah.
A little later on. But I think it's Sunday. Sunday she's on again now for the big showdown. So that should be good for sure.
Absolutely. And are you watching any of the coverage yourself now that you're home, or is there an Olympic sport, like another one apart from rowing, that you like to watch? Or are you just like, you know what, your head is full of it, you need a break? Like, do you try and kind of separate yourself from it?
No, I wouldn't say. Like, I don't think you need a break or anything. I enjoy the Olympics actually, but it's well, I actually value my sleep, and I was warning everyone while the race, the rowing was going on, I said don't bother getting out of bed to watch it. And I've actually followed up on that own advice myself. I've been getting my good night's sleep over here, and then kind of catch up on things then in the morning at a sensible hour.
I get it.
No, but I do. I enjoy a lot of the sports, actually. Like, the athletics is good. I enjoy that.
But come here, where is the gold medal at the moment?
So I was doing some pictures there for FBD, because they've been supporting me a long time. So I was out in the rowing club doing that. But with the medal, I left it in the car then, since then, I think.
Okay,
yeah.
And you know, I mean, we all love you because you're so relaxed and you're so down to earth. But like, winning the gold medal at the Olympics, it has to feel different. You know, I mean, does it feel bigger? Has it sunk in?
No, I don't think I can't figure out what there would be to sink in. Like, Joe's nice for sure. I don't feel different like at all.
Okay, and it's interesting.
You'd obviously be very happy, but I think I'd be trying to be happy about life anyway. You know.
And it's interesting because I was listening to Kelly Harrington obviously this morning as well, and she was saying the same. It's not the medals. It's the sense of pride and the people at home.
I haven't seen it yet. No, I was on very early, and I've been training and stuff since. But I'm going to try and catch a repeat now if I can.
Yeah.
A little later on. But I think it's Sunday. Sunday she's on again now for the big showdown. So that should be good for sure.
Absolutely.
Olympic gold medalist Paul O'Donovan talking to Catherine Thomas in the afternoon. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself. Till next time.